Hello and welcome to the Royal College of General Practitioners podcasts. My name's Dr. Thomas Round. I am the Essential Knowledge Updates Clinical Lead. And today I'm talking to colleague Carolyn Chu Graham, who is a professor at Keele University and GP in Manchester. And we'll be talking about the topic of depression. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, hello. Good to be here. And just to mention that I was on the guideline development group of the NICE depression guideline update, but I'm speaking on behalf of myself as a GP. I'm not speaking on behalf of NICE.
Thank you for saying that, Carolyn. Important to say. And you've got a research interest in mental health, understand?
Most of my research is around the management of people with mental health problems in primary care.
Great to have you and your expertise today. So we'll be talking about depression, and as GPs will know just how common mental health complaints are and consultations. So just maybe a little bit of background, what we mean by depression. And I guess it's in the context of having a lot of consultations due to mental health, but not everyone might not have depression or other labels.
Absolutely. And I will come back to that differentiation between depression and distress or stress, because I think that's something that we as GPs are challenged with. But what is depression? So the NICE definition is that depression refers to a wide range of mental health problems characterized by low mood, the absence of positive affect, loss of interest and enjoyment in things, and a range of other emotional, cognitive, physical and behavioral symptoms. And the recently published NICE guideline uses the terms less severe and more severe depression. So that's a change which we need to get used to. So less severe depression encompasses subthreshold and mild depression from the previous guidance, and more severe depression encompasses moderate and severe depression from the previous NICE guideline. And the updated NICE guideline talks about differentiating between less severe and more severe on the PHQ-9 scale, that's the patient health questionnaire 9 scale, of 16. So anybody with a PHQ-9 of less than 16 is thought by NICE to have a less severe depression, and anybody with a PHQ-9 of more than 16 has a more severe depression.
That's very useful. Thank you, Carolyn. I practice in a fairly deprived multi-ethnic area, and there's a lot of variation in how people might present with potential symptoms. I might have some reasonably health literate people saying, actually, I feel quite depressed and low, whilst other people might present with more physical symptoms. So that does present a challenge to us as general practitioners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think some cultures don't have a word for depression, and there is quite a lot of stigma around mental health problems compared to physical health. And so we need to be culturally sensitive in all our consultations and use the words that people use. So I've certainly done a lot of work around older adults and mental health problems, and again, there's a lot of stigma, a lot of stoicism, and older adults may not say the word depressed. They may say stress, they may say it's my nerves. So a lot of sensitivity around how we talk about depression and not impose our framework and our understanding on other people. I think it's also important to think about anxiety as being comorbid with depression, and alcohol and drug misuse. So it's really important, if we think someone has a mood problem, to ask about alcohol and drugs, because these can make depressive symptoms worse, and it certainly makes management more complex.
Are any particular patient groups more at risk of depression than others?
Really, and again, I've worked in this area, it's people with long-term physical conditions are at greater risk of developing depression and anxiety. And the more long-term conditions you have, the more likely you are to have depression and anxiety. It's really important to recognise depression and anxiety in these people, because it increases morbidity associated with the long-term condition. This may be due to a lack of motivation or lack of ability to self-manage. We know that comorbid anxiety and depression reduce the quality of life for people with long-term conditions. So it has an individual impact. It can also increase mortality. But also for the NHS, there are increased risk of hospital admissions, presentations to A&E, frequent consultation in general practice. So it's really important to identify depression and anxiety in people with long-term conditions and manage appropriately. I think all too often we've thought, oh, well, no wonder they're depressed. They've got COPD, they've got arthritis, they're in pain, I'd be depressed. And that normalisation of depression and therapeutic nihilism really does a disservice to our patients.
So that's a really top tip, really. I mean, think about that active case finding, think about your chronic patient reviews. Maybe also within your practice, if you're a lot of chronic disease managers with nurses. So I think some of the prompts and guidance and some of the templates do have depression screening built into them.
They used to, because QAF used to insist on case finding for people with diabetes and heart disease. So QAF had the PHQ-2 case finding questions in for about 3 years. But the evidence was that practice nurses really didn't like doing this. They didn't know how to handle when people said, yes, they might be depressed. There was this fear of opening up Pandora's box. And those case finding questions were dropped from QAF, and therefore they're not really in the templates that people use. That isn't to say that we shouldn't be looking at training our practice nurses who do the majority of chronic disease management in primary care to think about depression and to feel comfortable asking those questions, but also then to have a pathway to deal with people. So either signposting to social prescribing or to talking therapies or to the GP. We can't just ask practice nurses to do this without making sure they feel supported.
Yeah, totally. Thinking about how we might make that diagnosis. Got that sort of stat in my head of about 20% of primary care workload is around mental health, or probably more, and how common during lifetime anxiety or depression as a diagnosis would be.
So how do we make the diagnosis? Well, as you've said, some people will come in and say, I think I'm depressed. And that, in a way, makes it easier for the clinician to go down that pathway of asking the questions. Other times, we may suspect as a GP or as a clinician that somebody's depressed by looking at them. They may be tearful. They may be giving you lots of nonverbal clues. They may be presenting with physical symptoms that you can't make sense of, and you start to think, is there an underlying psychological worry here? I think, however the consultation opens, it's really important to give the person time, and I know that's at a premium at the moment. Listen to the patient, be empathic, take a really good history, not just about the current symptoms, but ask about previous history of mood problems, previous treatments, experience and understanding of previous treatments. Have they got any current problems, say at work or at home, any relationship problems, any financial concerns? Explore ICE, ideas, concerns, expectations. Why do they make the appointment? What do they want to achieve in the consultation? And always reflect back to the patient what you're hearing. And that may be things like, it sounds like you're depressed, or you look very tearful, or you seem upset. But allow the patient to open up a little bit more. As I said, it's really important to ask about alcohol and drugs. It's really important to ask about risk of self-harm, whether there's any suicidal ideation, and think about protective factors and how can you keep the patient safe if there is suicidal ideation. It's important not just to think about current symptoms, but go back, because most people will have developed depression or anxiety symptoms during their teenage years. We think that most people with mental health problems have got childhood trauma or neurodiversity, and that's a predisposing factor to developing low mood. So ask about, you know, what was their teenage years like? People often say, well, it's when I went to university that things got difficult. Ask about family history, because we know that if there's a strong family history, it increases the risk of depression in the individual. But also think about bipolar disorder. So if a person is describing where they've had episodes of depression, have they also had episodes where they're really creative, where they've not needed any sleep? And are people similarly affected in their family? Because again, a family history of bipolar disorder increases the risk for the individual developing bipolar.
Shows just the importance of a comprehensive clinical assessment, which can be obviously difficult. And, you know, I think with our trainees, we often say, look, it's that continuity. And a lot of people now are trying to move to 15-minute consultations or a bit more flexibility. So some of these patients will need a bit longer, maybe just for that initial risk assessment. As you say, the psychosocial history, children at home, risk factors, what's protective factors, what's going on at home or at work or in their life.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I'm talking through the list of things that we ought to cover, I think, gosh, we've only got 10-minute consultation, but you're absolutely right. We can extend that consultation, and that investment at the beginning and investing in that relationship is really worth it, because it makes management and support of that person going forwards much easier, much more satisfying for them, but also for the GP. But I think you're also right in that if we can achieve continuity, you don't have to necessarily do everything in the first session. So the first consultation, find out what the problems are, try to come to a negotiated plan, think about risk. But it may be that in the next consultation, you talk about family history, or you talk about, you know, risk of neurodiversity, or you talk about alcohol and drugs.
I think the key thing is obviously you're making that clinical impression, isn't it? You're making what you think is a diagnosis, maybe using the tools you mentioned, PHQ or the other tools.
PHQ-9 for depression and GAD-7 for anxiety. And they can be helpful. They can be helpful to assess severity. I use them when somebody comes in, sits down and says, I think I'm depressed. And when I've talked to them, I think, I'm not sure you are. So we'll use the PHQ-9 and they score 7. And I can say, actually, this is a really low score. And this is what we can do. But I also use the PHQ-9 when I have perhaps an older person or somebody who's not really keen on my suggestion that they might be depressed. And I'll use the PHQ-9 then and say, you're scoring 21. That suggests to me you might be depressed. Can we think about that a bit more?
Really useful top tip. And I think a lot of practices now, we kind of have this hybrid model. So I'm using a mixture of phone, online, face-to-face. So often we'll find maybe the younger people will use a sort of online tool to say I'm feeling a bit low, a bit down. I often find that then inviting them in for a face-to-face, I've gone back to actually get the cues as well. You know, little non-verbal cues can be very helpful. But I think it's having that hybrid approach, isn't it? And being flexible.
And what suits the patient? So I'm seeing online queries, people saying I've got mental health problems, I'm really stressed, and I feel those need to be responded to. People may be spoken to on the telephone. If that's done through an advanced nurse practitioner, then they need to be adequately trained. And I think there's nothing that beats a face-to-face consultation at some point just to establish a relationship and offer support, really assess risks and agree a management plan. But I think many people then are happy with telephone follow-up, particularly if they're at work. But it's about being patient-centered and flexible, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I often will have that face-to-face, build that rapport, but if people are working, I sometimes use the AccuRex or other text messaging function just to check in with people how they are. They can then send an update, you know, or you can send them links, which is really useful if they're not sure they want to start medication. So you can send really good tips on things about SSRI. NHS has a really good information portal, the different medications.
Certainly use those links to send people links to self-help services, and we have all that on our practice website as well. And so particularly it's useful, I think, when you get an online query, that whilst people are waiting for an appointment, whether that's a telephone or a face-to-face, they can be sent that information. They can be sent a message that, you know, if you feel you're at risk, then please contact us again. So it does offer us perhaps a little bit more than we had, you know, before we were using online consultations, where people were making appointments and it might be 2 weeks in advance and we had no way of knowing that they were at risk.
Absolutely. And it's good. I mean, I think most areas will have the talking therapies and patients can self-refer to those, I think, in most areas. And I think a lot of practices we've got as part of the practice networks, we've got a primary care mental health worker who can see people first off without having to see the GP necessarily. So I think that all that's kind of helpful, I think, in terms of that larger clinical team.
And I think if they're based in the practice, that does reduce the stigma. It makes it more normal for mental health to be seen as part of the primary care offerings, rather than people having to be referred, having to go to something that is labelled a mental health or psychiatry service.
So then moving on, so we feel we've made that diagnosis, maybe using the tools like you said, that sort of assessment. Maybe we're thinking more it's that moderate to severe depression, which might benefit from medication. What would the next steps be? As you say, it's kind of differentiating, isn't it, between what we previously called moderate to severe to the more milder mental health conditions.
I think there's probably a step before that, that for some people, you do need to do some investigation. Mm-hmm. So certainly in older adults, I would normally do a full blood count, I'd check thyroid, I'd check their renal function. In younger people, I wouldn't. There is a group of patients who may come in with non-specific physical symptoms where they admit to feeling depressed, distressed, but actually they feel that there's something causing it. And so again, I might do some blood tests, explain to them that I think they're going to be normal, but we'll do them. But whilst we're waiting for the results, shall we explore their mood a bit further? So I think there are some circumstances where I would put that in.
And I think a lot of people, like we said, might have comorbidity. So actually it's a useful consultation anyway to review maybe diabetes or other health conditions that they have, chronic pain, etc.
Absolutely. And so then I would hopefully have agreed with a person that they felt this was low mood, that they might want to call it depression, they might want to call it stress. What are the options of managing it? And so I would follow the NICE guidance around active monitoring and giving information. So I'd talk to them about alcohol and drugs, if it was relevant. I talked to them about sleep and the importance of sleep hygiene, highlighting some of the available links that we've got around sleep advice. I talked to them about activity and exercise, yoga and mindfulness, the fact that there's mixed evidence for these, but it's likely that it will make them feel better if they can give themselves time for themselves. I might talk about social prescribing, particularly if somebody's they've got financial problems or housing problems that's contributing to their low mood. I talk about NHS talking therapies, which was formerly called IAPT, Improving Access to Psychological Therapies. And as you say, Thomas, people can refer themselves now, and I would encourage them to do that, send them the links. If there are any risk concerns, then obviously we talk about that, how they would keep themselves safe. And I'd also talk about something called behavioural activation, how they can help structure their day, structure their life, if you like, to make themselves feel better. So incorporate some activity or some yoga or some time doing creative activities, schedule it in, get that positive reinforcement, and that's going to lift their mood. And I think behavioural activation is a really useful strategy that we can use in routine consultations. If someone's got severe depression, then I think I would say to them, I think antidepressants are probably indicated here. There's a good evidence base for them. Similarly, people who have got long-term conditions with depression, then antidepressants are indicated there according to the NICE guideline in people with long-term physical conditions. And the previous NICE guideline on depression talked about sub-threshold depression with functional impairment. And that really still stands. So if someone's got ongoing depressive symptoms, it's affecting their ability to work or function in the family, they've not responded to talking treatments, then I would think about antidepressants.
That's a really good stepwise approach. I think in a lot of areas, there's still those kind of long waiting lists for talking therapies. Absolutely, it's quite clear if someone's got a severe, moderate to severe depression, then medication might be, you know, give people that option to try that. It can be difficult then if people have got 2 to 3 month or longer waiting lists for talking therapy, more for the milder symptoms, what to do in the meantime. But absolutely, you can do all the behaviour, psychosocial, thinking about exercise, what works for them really. There's some evidence for mindfulness, some evidence for yoga, but it depends if it works for you. Not, I've tried mindfulness, I can't really do it, but I enjoy yoga. So it's seeing what works for them really, isn't it?
Yeah. Again, it's about being person-centered. Yep. And I think we shouldn't be giving antidepressants just because there's a long wait for talking therapies. Yep. I think it's really important that if someone's got a mild symptoms, their PHQ-9 is 10, we should be saying antidepressants probably won't work and you may get side effects like weight gain or reduced libido. Let's think about other things that you can do to help your mood while you wait for talking therapies.
That's really helpful. And I often signpost to people who enjoy reading to some of their self-help books. I've read some of those myself. So the Overcoming series, Overcoming Depression, Overcoming Anxiety. I found a quite helpful book as well called Acceptance Commitment Therapy for Dummies. So I think we can do a little bit of psychology within our consultations. Obviously, we're not psychology trained necessarily, but, you know, actually thinking about some of those CBT techniques or other behaviour change techniques can be helpful.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, behavioural activation is such an important strategy to use because it's quick. It's about helping people reflect on what used to give them pleasure, what they could do now, because obviously sometimes they'll say, well, I used to go to the cinema once a week, but I've got kids now and I've got no support. So I can't. What could you do instead? Can you put that hour a week or 2 hours a week? Can you schedule it so that it's time for you? And really making people focus down on how they can help themselves, how they can help themselves feel better. Giving them permission to sometimes. People lead very busy lives and often they just need to step back and think, actually, I'm important. I need to prioritise myself.
Coming on to that medication discussion, so we've made that diagnosis, we've had that discussion with council people about SSRIs. They might want some time to think about it, so I often say that's absolutely fine. Yeah. I send them the link to the NHS SSRI guidance, there's some good information on there. Maybe have that follow-up conversation and then people would be happy to start. So from my own 10 years of being a GP, sertraline would be one, isn't it, that we use a lot, particularly in women, safe in pregnancy. So and I often start low, go slow sometimes, just to minimise side effects. So I often advise half 50 milligrams, so 25 milligrams up to a week and then going up to 50. But I think you can increase reasonably quickly if they haven't got side effects, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I tend to start actually at 50. I think people vary. Yeah. And I think it also depends if someone's reluctant or worried about side effects, then actually asking them to halve it and going up slowly is a really good idea. Certainly don't start above 50. Preferably review in a couple of weeks. Now that can be done on the telephone, as you say, it could be done through Accurix. But I think it's really important to establish that you're interested, that you're going to support people, and that you offer review with yourself, so you're proactive. And I know that there's pressure on appointments, and people listening to this may go, oh, we haven't got the capacity. But I think it's worth it in the long run because it is an investment in getting people better. And review their symptoms, make sure they've not got any side effects. I always advise people that even with sertraline, they may get a bit of nausea, a bit of feeling not quite there, a bit of faintness. Those normally settle down within a couple of days. But I always say, if you're having problems, contact the practice. First of all, we've given them a warning about side effects, but also we're here to support them if they do get side effects. Review them in 2 weeks, review them in another 2 weeks, try and push the dose up. Sometimes people will get to 100 of sertraline actually and say, actually, I feel fine. I've got no side effects. I don't want to go up any further. Other people, you may need to go up to 200. But all the time having ongoing reviews with people, and that frequency will depend on how quickly they improve. And once they're stable, you may want to reduce the frequency of reviews. But what we don't want is to then leave people languishing on antidepressants for years. So we need right at the beginning to say to people, you probably need to stay on an antidepressant for 6 to 12 months after you've started to feel better. And we certainly need to have a discussion at that point as to whether we can reduce and possibly stop the antidepressant. It's really important that you combine the antidepressant with talking treatments. So try and encourage people to do both, not just rely on the medication. And make sure that they know not to stop the antidepressant suddenly because of the risk of withdrawal effects. And for them to know that they can have a discussion when they feel ready to stop with you and have a slow, supervised reduction.
That's really helpful. And I think the data all supports that all antidepressants will have a little bit of weight gain, but it is variable from, I think there was quite a good couple of years ago, meta-analysis in the BMJ. So the one with the highest weight gain, as I understand, is mirtazapine. Yeah. But actually, that can be a positive thing if you've got someone, a particularly elderly person, maybe yeah. who's not sleeping well, who's got low appetite, lost weight. Actually, I sometimes just use it as an adjunct, like 7.5 milligram or 15 milligram with mirtazapine. So that's one I quite commonly use, sertraline as well. I use fairly often kind of escitalopram. That's come off patent. So there's a little bit of evidence escitalopram is maybe a bit better for anxiety symptoms rather than
depression. It is slightly cleaner than citalopram. So yes, I think it's fine to use because, as you say, it's come off patent, so it's cheaper.
And any of the sort of top tips on prescribing?
I think we've covered it really. Start low, go slow, offer proactive follow-up, ensure that people have a plan as to this is not long-term, but it's long-term in the sense of it's probably a year, but then please make an appointment. We're going to discuss reducing the dose. We're going to reduce very slowly. We'll do it with my support. I think that's the key thing. Preferably not to prescribe on the first consultation unless somebody has got really severe depression. So give people a chance to think about it, understand the risks and benefits, and then make sure that the person has a plan. They know what they're doing for the next 12 months. They know that they're going to be seeing or speaking to the GP about the antidepressants and reviewing their mood, and then you'll support them reducing. And the NICE guideline now says very clearly that reduction should be slow. It should be accompanied, if possible, by some talking therapies. The NICE guideline talks about trying to use liquid preparations. Now, obviously, those are expensive, and so the advice tends to be that we're not allowed to prescribe liquid preparations, but people can buy tablet cutters, cut them in half. And so making sure that a person understands, has it written down, this is the reducing regime that I'm following.
This will be some online resources for that as well that can help support patient management. And again, using the ACURIC system, I often say I'll discuss it with you. And we know patients only probably take 50% or less, probably less than that, isn't it, in the consultation. So I often say I'll summarize with a plan for you onto your phone and with a link. But I think, as you say, the continuity of care is so important. Every time I adjust a dose, I probably would, especially that initiation phase as well, I'd see the patient fairly regularly, and it would depend on the symptoms and severity and risks.
Absolutely. So I've got somebody in face-to-face, I will write down the reducing regime. But as you say, if it's a telephone consultation, then sending up a follow-up text, I think, is really helpful for them.
Maybe in that initial assessment, if we're going more then on the severe side and doing that sort of risk assessment, it can provoke some anxiety about asking about self-harm. I think it's just about normalizing, isn't it, with trainees and in your experience of just saying this is a normal question we ask everyone around their mental health. Have you had thoughts about harming yourself in any way, or how has that affected you?
Yes, it's really important for all clinicians to feel comfortable asking about it. 20 years ago, we used to say, oh, don't ask because it will put the idea into the head. That is complete rubbish. They've got the ideas in the head. We need to help them disclose it. And we may want to just ask straight out, have you ever thought about harming yourself? But we may say, some people, when they're feeling like you do, feeling as low as you do, feel like harming themselves, taking their own lives. Have you ever felt like that? And I think clinicians can develop a script to feel comfortable with. And once you've got that in your head, I mean, I've got those two scripts, and I use them depending on how the consultations go, how I feel the patient would respond to that question. But it really is important that anybody who in primary care who's dealing with people who are depressed feel comfortable asking those questions and then have something to do with the answer. So again, we don't want to leave our advanced nurse practitioners or our healthcare assistants asking the questions, but then thinking, I don't know what to do. There's no GP that I can ask, you know, what's happening here. So I think training for the whole clinical team is really important.
That might be on your risk assessment that they might need extra support or referral. Obviously, some patients might have at the severe end of the spectrum psychotic type symptoms.
although the majority of people are managed in primary care and they've got depression and anxiety, sometimes we do need to refer to specialist care. So risk of suicide is one of those eventualities. So hopefully we all have a home-based treatment team or a crisis team that we can refer to, and we hope that they're going to be responsive. There are other people who may need referral to specialist care in less acute situations. So somebody who's been tried on a number of antidepressants, who has tried talking therapies and really isn't improving. We call that treatment-resistant depression, but I think that's quite a pejorative term because it sort of implies that the patient's at fault. Mm. But people who've not responded to all the strategies that we've given them, 3 or 4 antidepressants, they need to see specialist care, a psychiatrist. And again, we have to hope that the threshold for community mental health teams is not so high that those people can't be seen. Mm. Similarly, if as a GP we think about bipolar, actually this person's had recurrent episodes of depression. They sort of describe being a bit euphoric in between, but actually they quite like that because it makes them productive and that's what got through their degree. But actually, you know, am I missing bipolar here? And they've not really improved with an antidepressant. Again, we have to hope that we can get them seen by specialist care because we can't make that diagnosis of bipolar. It has to be a psychiatrist.
I think I'm quite lucky. I work in clinically in East London, so we have regular MDT with our psychiatrist where we discuss cases and I can email them and get rapid guidance and information. So actually that sort of integrated care works really well. So yeah. I think it's good to developing those relationships. They want to see the people who are quite sick, and it might be that's discharging some people to primary care with the primary care liaison worker, but you know, being able to refer back rapidly for advice if needed.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a number of models, aren't there, of primary, second liaison or psychiatrists visiting the practice. We can contact the psychiatrist on a Wednesday at 1 o'clock, which can be helpful. It's not if you don't work on a Wednesday at 1 o'clock. But yes, I think having access to a psychiatric opinion to go, just I'm really concerned about this person. Can you help? And sometimes that help and advice that you get enables you to hold them in primary care and feel quite comfortable about doing that.
And I guess, Carolyn, you're obviously interested in this area, doing research and working on the NICE guidelines. Where's kind of next for you and your work in this area?
Something I alluded to earlier, that it's really important for us to be able to distinguish distress and stress from depression. And I think GPs have been criticised in the past for missing depression, so people were untreated. But we've also been criticised for over-medicalising normal life distress. So I'm working with a team in Southampton led by Adam Geraghty, where we're looking at a new scale that was developed in the Netherlands, actually. And this scale looks at different domains. So it's much broader than the PHQ-9. And hopefully we'll be able to, well, we are having a look to see if it can be used in primary care to see if it's acceptable to patients. But also, is it acceptable to general practitioners? Can it be used within a consultation? Could it be used between consultations as a part of discussion and decision making around treatment? So I think that's one thing that we hope is going to come to fruition. I think we need to look at the role of social prescribing in the management of people with depression. I think social prescribing has been introduced as almost a cure-all, and we don't know for particular patient groups how useful, effective it is. And I think there's also some work to be done about the use of long-term antidepressants and how safe they are. So Tony Kendrick, a professor in Southampton's done a great programme of work around reducing antidepressants, and I certainly draw on that in my clinical work, but I think there's more to be done in that arena.
Thanks, Carolyn. And I would also signpost people to looking at the college website. We've got the EKU module on depression. We've also got other resources on mental health as well, so please do have a little look at our website. Yeah, and Carolyn, just any final top tips? I think we've discussed most things, but you know, patient-centred, that risk assessment, really counselling, continuity of care, thinking about the right medication or the right therapy for the patient.
I think you've summed it up. For me, it's person-centred care delivered within a relationship, so continuity of care. Those are the key points for me.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and thank you for listening to the RCGP podcasts.